The Nature Podcast is supported by Nature Plus, a flexible monthly subscription that grants immediate online access to the science journal Nature and over 50 other journals from the Nature portfolio. More information at go.nature.com/plus.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
This week, Eternal Sunshine of the Positive Mindset.
If we boost positive memory by activating memory carrying cells, we may be able to restore more normal behavior.
And our plant friends may be brainless, but are they intelligent?
Once you accept intelligence is a capacity for problem solving, then plants solve an enormous number of problems.
Plus, we explore a gaggle of little exoplanets. This is the Nature Podcast for June the 18th, 2015. I'm Kerry Smith.
And I'm Adam Levy. Until the 1990s, astronomers could only fantasize about planets orbiting stars other than our sun. Now, we know about thousands of these exoplanets. But what can we learn about these distant worlds? Mostly, not much, just their size. In a few cases, though, it's been possible to calculate the size and mass of these exoplanets, giving us clues to their composition. Research led by Daniel Jontoff Hutter of Pennsylvania State University has been able to make these measurements for the smallest exoplanet yet. The planet is one of a family of three going around a star named Kepler-138, about 200 light-years away. For comparison, our sun is just 8 light-minutes away. But how do we even spot these planets in the first place? Here's Daniel.
Planets orbit their stars in a flat plane, and if we're lucky enough to be in that same plane as a planet as it orbits its star, we can see it pass in front of the star every orbit. And so every time it passes in front of the star, it blocks a little bit of the starlight, and the star's brightness is temporarily reduced. So we can measure how big the planet is because it's blocking a certain fraction of the starlight, and what its orbital period is, how long its year is. And so for these planets at Kepler-138, their orbital periods are much shorter than the Earth's orbital period. They orbit their host star every 10 days, 14 days, and 23 days. There are three planets that are transiting that star.
What does this information tell us about these planets? What does it have the potential to tell us about these planets?
Once you have its mass and its size, you can measure its density. And you can compare its density to metal or rock or water or gas and start modeling what the planet's made of, its composition. You can also, if you have its mass and its size, you can measure how strong gravity is on the surface of the planet. And so if it has an atmosphere, you can start trying to understand that.
And how did you go about measuring the mass of these planets in this paper?
In the Kepler dataset of their transits, you can measure the time of the transit, the exact moment when they pass in front of the star, very, very precisely, with a precision of a few minutes. But their gravities affecting each other can change the time of the transit from what you'd expect by several minutes, up to an hour in some cases. And so in this system, all three planets are transiting. So if we study the system as a whole, we get all three planets' masses and all three planet sizes.
Have these types of observations been used before to measure the mass of exoplanets?
Yes, they have, because Kepler has measured these transits so precisely for such a long time, for 4 years. We have a data set where we can actually use this technique. So this is not the first system where the technique has been applied. It's the system with the smallest masses where this technique has been used.
What did you actually learn about these planets once you started to analyze them and trying to investigate their masses?
In the case of Kepler-138b, it's the first exoplanet smaller than the Earth to have its mass and radius measured. So it's pushing the boundaries to how small we can go in terms of characterizing low-mass planets. The outer two planets are also interesting. They have a similar size, they're just slightly larger than the Earth, but they have a big difference in density. The middle planet is probably a mixture of rock and metal like the Earth, but the outermost planet is less dense than rock, but probably denser than water. So it could be a mixture of water and rock, or a mixture of gases and rock. And so we're learning a little bit about the compositions of these planets from their densities. And we're trying to get as many of these systems analyzed as possible so we can compare other planetary systems to our own.
What other observations do you think might be possible in the future for exoplanets? At the moment, we can measure their size, we can measure their mass in certain cases. Do you think there are other things that might be possible to measure in the future for exoplanets?
So if transiting exoplanets pass in front of the star and they have an atmosphere, in some cases, we can observe the starlight passing through their atmosphere and get a spectrum of the planet's atmosphere. And you can learn a lot about a planet if you can measure the composition of its atmosphere, of course. The next big NASA mission to study transiting exoplanets is the TESS mission, due to launch in 2 years. It is going to look for exoplanets around stars all around the sky. So the Kepler field was a small patch of sky with hundreds of thousands of stars. The TESS mission will discover thousands of exoplanets, including ones that are relatively close to our solar system, like Kepler-138.
Looking forwards, what do you think are the big challenges for the exoplanet community? What are the things that people would like to find out about exoplanets that currently are difficult or impossible to find out?
What we really want to know is how planets form and how our own solar system formed. It turns out that systems like our solar system are not the norm. They're not common. We don't know why. We would like to be able to understand how the enormous variety that is seen in exoplanets came about, and learn about how common planets like the Earth are.
Thanks, Daniel. To find out more about the three planets orbiting Kepler-138, head over to nature.com/nature.
So Adam, when we've exhausted all the Earth's resources, can we go and live on one of these?
No. So none of these planets are actually in the habitable zone of Kepler-138. So don't think you're going to be escaping there anytime soon.
Good news stories all round from the Nature podcast. Coming up, replaying positive memories lifts depression in mice. And in the research highlights, drunk chimps and Cretaceous cell biology.
But first, Sharmini Bundell took a field trip to Regent's Park last week with Chris Surridge, the editor of Nature Plants, to ask him about the idea of plant intelligence and whether we're severely underestimating our photosynthetic cousins.
So we've come from the Nature office out to Regent's Park, so we can sit in among the trees and the grass. Everything looks pretty still apart from the rustling of the leaves, but is there more activity going on out here than we can appreciate?
There's a lot of activity going on out here. The roots of these trees are growing all the time. Although we can't hear it, we can't see it, the tips of the shoots of these trees are growing all the time. And often, these trees are quite close together. What they're trying to do is to make sure that their leaves are in the sun. They've got to get more leaves out from the shade of all the other trees that are around them. So, in fact, the trees around us are in mortal combat with each other to try and get that little bit more sunlight than the guy next to them. So there's an awful lot of movement going on in these plants around us. It's just that it's happening on scales that we're not good at looking at.
Plants are really complex. Do you think that they're intelligent?
I think most people, if they don't work on plants and don't tend to think about how plants operate, will think plant intelligence is rubbish. These are people who talk to plants to make them grow better. I mean, they're not intelligent in the way that we are. We're intelligent. We can play games, we can answer mathematical problems, things like that. There's no way that plants can do that. What plants can do is that they sense their environment, they react to their environment, they do complicated calculations to predict what's happening in the world ahead. And in some respects, that is a way of defining intelligence. I mean, for example, a plant during the nighttime has to do a whole lot of chemical reactions, behaviours that are different from what it does in the daytime. And because of that, it's very useful for the plant to know when the sun's going to come up in the morning. And in fact, it's an advantage to it to get itself ready in the half hour, hour before the sun comes up. Therefore, it's doing complicated calculations every day about how long the night will be, how long it has been since it started the night, what time of year it is, in order to for it to determine exactly when the sun's going to come up so it can be ready before that. You could consider that to be a kind of intelligence.
Leaving Chris in the park for a moment, I wanted to look a bit more into this idea of plant intelligence. It's a pretty provocative phrase and one that's been being debated for some years. One proponent of the idea of plant intelligence is Professor Anthony Trawavas, who I spoke to on the phone from Edinburgh. Tony, you've written a book that's being reviewed in Nature this week, the title of which is Plant Behaviour and Intelligence.
Yes.
Now, when we say intelligence, we often mean thinking in the way that humans think. But how should we be describing what plants are doing?
My reaction is to put it down in terms of not so much thinking, because that may be a product of a nervous system, but the business of assessment. There has to be an assessment about which is going to be the advantageous way, the way which improves the fitness of the individual. I mean, the conclusion I come to is that what we recognise as intelligent behaviour is problem solving. But once you accept that intelligence is the capacity for problem solving, then plants solve an enormous number of problems in their situation.
In terms of how we judge other organisms, humans seem pretty self-centred then.
We've always assumed that being humans and top of the tree, as it were, that we're the only beasts that can be intelligent. And I think that's a terribly arrogant attitude. And now we are starting to investigate what goes on in the real biological world. We are finding these surprising behaviours everywhere.
Thanks, Tony. Back in the park with Chris Surridge, I'm starting to appreciate the apparently inanimate landscape all around us.
Are plants more similar to us than we realise?
I think that's certainly true. They certainly do a lot of interactions. We tend to think of plants sitting in isolation, whereas actually they are interacting with each other all of the time. These trees all around us are desperately competing with the tree next to them. For light. They are also communicating with them about threats that might come along. If a plant gets attacked by a herbivore, you start crushing it, they basically scream to tell everyone around them that that's what's happening. They don't scream with sound. What they do is they release a whole lot of volatile chemicals. So there's a whole lot of things going on that is just happening with senses that we just fail to notice. I think a lot of intelligence research has always been how close is something to up to me. The closer it is to me, the more intelligent it is. When we talk about plants having intelligence, what we're really doing is trying to point out that we don't know what intelligence really is, and that you haven't defined intelligence particularly well.
That was Sharmini Bundell stopping to enjoy the flowers with Chris Surridge, editor of Nature Plants. And before that, she was on the phone to Anthony Trawavas, whose book is reviewed in Nature this week.
The best science news from elsewhere now is the research highlights. Here's Jeff Marsh.
Last week, reporter Noah was telling us that chimps had the mental capacity for cooking. Well, it turns out that they enjoy a drink too. Wild chimps living in West Africa have been caught stealing villagers' booze. Villagers in Guinea leave containers under raffia palms to collect their fermented sap. The cheeky local chimps have learned to dip leaves into the container to sponge the sap out. It's the first systematic evidence that non-human primates ingest fermented food and suggests that our ancestors could tolerate ethanol. The find is reported in the Royal Society Open Science Journal. It's Jurassic World Week. The film is out, and what better time to tell you that a team has just found remarkable soft tissue preserved in dinosaur bones. The bones are around 75 million years old and harbour evidence of connective tissue and maybe even blood cells. It's not the first time that the claim has been made, but in previous studies, evidence of proteins has often been poorly preserved. This team used a precise set of tools to extract and prepare samples and then studied them using a very high-res microscope. They found beautifully preserved tissue that looks like protein. The cells could allow studies of dino metabolism. But cloning, not likely. Jurassic Park is a cinema-only experience. That paper is in Nature Communications.
There's power in positive thinking. Okay, it's a cliche, but it's actually come true in a study in mice. A team led by Susumu Tonegawa at MIT used a clever technique to replay a mouse's positive memory while it was having a stressful, difficult time. They used a technique called optogenetics to switch on cells that held the pleasurable memory using a blue light. These cells are in a part of the brain called the hippocampus, which we know is heavily involved in memory. The team found that these positive mice reacted better to the stressful situation, whereas other mice showed depressive symptoms. I got Susumu on the line. So you were looking at the effects of almost replaying a positive memory, a pleasurable memory, in mice at times of stress.
Yes, you can say the replaying, but we can also say that we are letting mouse to remember, recall the wonderful experience they had before they got stressed.
And what gave you the idea that a positive memory, or at least the cells associated with a positive memory, could help alleviate depression-like symptoms?
We have previous studies in which we demonstrated that when you have a pleasurable memory and also sort of a fearful memory successively, then these two memories compete inside the brain of mice. So we thought if we take advantage of this competition between a positive and negative memory and boost positive memory by activating memory carrying cells, we may be able to restore more normal behavior.
Now, when you tested this theory in mice, that positive memories could help alleviate depression, you took mice and you had to give them first a positive or a negative experience or a neutral experience. What did those experiences look like for the mice?
For this experiment, we used male mice. And then before they receive a chronic stress, we let these male mice to play with a female mouse for an hour or so, and then subject them to a standard procedure for giving them chronic stress.
So having had this delightful experience where these male mice get to play with the females, then you put them in a stressful situation, and those mice where you reactivate the positive memory using optogenetics, they weren't depressed by it.
That's exactly right.
And did it last, this effect?
That's a good question. It will last at least two days, as far as we have done. 2 days doesn't sound like a very long time, but at least it lasts beyond the period where animal is receiving the proper blue light. In order to extend this finding with the mice, for the possible therapy in a human, there are a lot of optimization to be done. And also, in case of depression patients, there had to be new technology which is less invasive, but there is a possibility that patients which do not respond well to drugs can be treated by this direct manipulation of a very specific area of the brain which is supposed to hold the pleasurable memory.
But wouldn't you have to be very specific about that? So, for example, if you were trying to stimulate with an electrode in a human brain, which does sometimes happen for severe depression, what if you stimulated just a little bit off target? You'd stimulate negative memories instead.
Yeah, exactly. So that is the problem of deep brain stimulation is already being done. For instance, in case of Parkinson's disease. But at the same time, this stimulation procedure is very crude.
And do any current therapies for depression, either drugs or talk therapy, are they known to stimulate the same circuits as this does?
Yes, that's what we believe. When you give drugs, drug works in everywhere in the brain. There are no targeting. So the general direction of this new brain research is that in addition to drug treatment, we may be able to target, find the specific area of the brain which is abnormal and be able to manipulate that specific area.
And I suppose it gives some support, doesn't it, from a biological stance to the idea that recalling positive memories could help alleviate depression.
That's right. So at the minimum, what we have shown is we gave a justification for the psychotherapy, which is being carried out already without really knowing what's going on in the brain. In the future, we would like to be able to do this kind of targeted stimulation of the brain in a more non-invasive or low-invasive method, including some kind of wireless method. So this type of research will encourage for the development of the technologies like that.
That was researcher Susumu Tonegawa at MIT in Boston. Fun fact about Susumu, he actually won a Nobel Prize in 1987 for work on antibodies before switching to study memory. You can find the paper at nature.com/nature, as always, where there's also a news and views. Finally this week, it's the news, and Lizzie Gibney is here. You know Lizzie, she's our physics nerd, and she's been in touch with Philae.
I wish I had personally. That would be amazing. Now, we got some great news on Sunday. In fact, Saturday night, quite late. The signal came in at the European Space Agency. Philae is awake on the comet, and Rosetta can very occasionally hear from it at the moment. So there were some very excited people on Sunday when this happened.
If for any reason listeners managed to miss this event, what happened was Philae, this little lander, was shot down onto the surface of a comet, which we call 67P for short. And then, unfortunately, the sun kind of went behind a cloud, out of shot, and it lost its solar power.
It had its own batteries that lasted for the first few days. It had a bit of a rough landing. It hit the right spot, but then bounced a couple of times because its harpoons failed to dig in on the surface. And it ended up kind of tilted at the bottom of a cliff and in the shade. The hope was that as the comet crept closer to the sun, the sunlight would be more intense, and then there would be enough power generated through the solar panels that it could start up again.
Which is exactly what happened.
Which is what happened.
Yay! Right? Everything's great now, isn't it?
Yes and no. Everything is great for Philae in the sense that it is warmer than they thought it would be. It has more power than they thought it would have. And it can, with that power, it can start science activities. The issue is, at the moment, the communication between Philae and Rosetta isn't great. Rather than back in November, they had about 4 hours to talk to each other. The communications they've had so far have been a matter of a few minutes, and some of them were interrupted. So in that circumstance, it's very hard to actually start doing science because you need to send it a lot of commands. So what they're doing is they've had a little chat with the people who run the orbiter, and they've decided that they're going to switch the trajectory of Rosetta so that they can hopefully align the antenna of the two a little bit better. And in that way, they should be able to get a really stable communications link through which then they will be able to do all the great science. But I think that's happening, in fact, on Wednesday when this comes out. So by the end of the week, we should hopefully be starting to have some real comet science from the little lander that could.
And what is the promise? I mean, what kind of science would people like it to be able to do?
So it's going to start off relatively slowly doing the less energy intensive activities. So looking at the magnetic field and the electric field on the comet. Some of the other activities, which are the really exciting things that it could do, like using the drill to get some samples so it can study not just the bits of dust and gas that are sublimated into the coma, the atmosphere around the comet, but we can actually look at the materials that don't get sublimated, then that might be really exciting science because that might be amino acids, the kinds of things that we hope to find that could actually maybe even indicate that some of the building blocks of life were brought to planets like our own on comets.
No pressure, Philae. Keep talking.
None at all.
And nice to have you back, Philae. I don't know why I'm talking to you, because there's very little communication and very little power.
Well, it does tweet. So,
oh, that's marvellous. We'll look out for that. We're going to move on to something that's only marginally less cool and less hip than the Philae lander on a comet. And these are 2D materials. So graphene, of course, being the buzzword for these things.
Everybody's heard of graphene. There are not enough superlatives in the world to describe graphene. But whilst everyone has heard of graphene, especially because there was that nice Nobel Prize in 2010, what maybe fewer people will know about is that being able to isolate graphene spurred a huge number of other 2D materials to be explored. And the thing is with graphene is, as amazing as it is, one thing it doesn't have is something called a band gap, which basically just means in a material that has a band gap, you can give it a bit of energy and it will kick an electron up into the conduction band. And by doing that, you have the ability to switch its conducting on and off. That's what silicon does. That's what you need for it to be used in transistors, in the kind of basics of any electronic circuit. Why some of these materials are very exciting is because they are semiconductors. So we might be able to have, the hope is we might be able to have something like silicon, but in just a 2D layer. The hope is with these systems, they'll be less power hungry and they'd be a lot smaller. But there's also, the great thing about these 2D materials really is that actually when they're in their single layer form versus any kind of bulk form, their properties change entirely. So actually there's some really cool new uses that potentially are opening up, like spintronics and all kinds of things.
These are just basically other ways of kind of conveying that.
Exactly. So at the moment, an electronic circuit is about moving charges around, and that's how we communicate, how we carry, encode the information. What you'd be doing in spintronics is using the spin of an electron, which is either up or down. It's like a little internal bar magnet. It's all kind of very speculative, but it's also something that's really exciting people at the moment.
Is this too speculative?
Well, we have fads like this that come around every few years. What I think, I would say that I think something will come of it. And in fact, we quote someone in the piece saying, at the moment, the interest is all in this high-end digital electronics. But maybe it's going to be exactly like with the laser or something. You know, we come up with this new technology and actually you don't end up using it for any kind of the reasons you think you will. So it might be that we'll end up with 2D materials in all other kinds of places, but not for electronics. But I think they'll find a place, I think.
All right. Well, thank you, Lizzie, for coming in. And won't you just tell listeners about one other story that we haven't got time to talk about in depth, but is a little bit mind-blowing. They can find it on the website.
This is really fun. My working title for this piece has been Schrodinger's Cat in Space. I will leave it there, I think.
Okay. Good teaser. I like it. Nature.com/news is the place to find out about cats in space and also all the other stuff we've been talking about.
And landers in space.
Landers in space, 2D materials firmly on the ground in labs. Thanks, Lizzie.
Next week, the icy wilderness teeming with life. What lives in Antarctica? And how? I'm Adam Levy.
And I'm Kerry Smith.
Deep dive into the world of science with Nature Plus. From the vastness of the distant star systems to the intricacies of infectious diseases due to climate change, we've got you covered. Enjoy access to over 55 cutting-edge journals, breaking scientific news, and over 1,000 new articles every month. Whether you're a seasoned researcher or just curious, Nature Plus simplifies complex studies. Plus, it's all available right at your fingertips on nature.com. Nature Plus, the key to unlocking the world's most significant scientific advances. Subscribe today at go.nature.com/plus.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.